The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I talked about particular teachings of the Buddha that are called the Kalama Sutta teachings. And the salient point there that I was making is that the Buddha did not... When people came to him perplexed about all the different spiritual teachings that existed at their time, he said that... Then they asked him, what amongst them can we say is true or false? He declined to answer the question true and false about teachings. But rather, he was interested in action, what we do and what we don't do. And that what we do and don't do, that leads to the end of greed, hate, and delusion. And so that's a peculiar kind of stance for a great spiritual teacher, to decline saying what the teachings are and rather focusing on action. Perhaps some people would think that. And then at the end of that talk, Ganesh, who is not here today, asked about, brought up a different teaching that is maybe a little bit similar. And sometimes this teaching is often put together with the Kalama Sutta. And it's the teachings the Buddha gave to his foster mother. And here also we see that when he had the option, it looks like the option, or asked the question, what is your teaching? He doesn't give doctrinal teachings, but he gives something else. And we see that repeatedly in his teachings, that it's not teachings as doctrine, not something you would learn, memorize, but it's very practical and pragmatic, and it has to do with qualities of mind, the activities that we do that lead to something that transform us in some way, rather than something we have to believe necessarily. So this particular teaching was from his foster mother. And the context of it is very important, because without giving the context, it's easy to listen to it through your own context, whatever that might be, and then say, well, that doesn't work, or that's not interesting, or somehow it's kind of shallow or something. But if we appreciate the context in which it's given, then perhaps we can imagine ourselves in this kind of context as well, and maybe then these teachings have a little bit more power. So his foster mother, her name is Gotami, Ma Pajapati Gotami. We have a statue of her in the outer hall there. She became a nun at some point, ordained by the Buddha. And the story of her leaving her, she was part of the royal family in the Buddha's home country, leaving her home country with a bunch of other women, and shedding all their jewelry and their fancy clothes, whatever they had, their palaces, and apparently walking barefoot, just with simple clothes, across northern India to find the Buddha in order to ask for ordination. And one story talks about how their feet were kind of dried and bloody from that walk. So one of the things that I understand from that story is that she was very motivated. This was very important for her, that somehow the life that she was living wasn't really speaking to her or important for her anymore, or wasn't really where she was going to find something much more important. And somehow the Buddha and his lifestyle, his teachings, practices that he had, that they somehow were important enough that she left everything behind in order to go and take up a contemplative life. We have to remember that in that time in ancient India, there wasn't a Insight Meditation Center down the street. There weren't retreat centers, an hour away that you could drive to. The options for a lay person who's busy with their lives, I mean, they didn't have, they didn't have unions and didn't have obligatory, vacation time from work. And many people were working very hard just to get by. So the ability to step out of your life in order to go off for, a few days, a week, a month, to be on retreat, that is possible for some of us here was probably unthinkable back then, it wasn't a common thing, it wasn't an obvious thing. And we have this, some of us have this amazing luxury to be able to go off for a week on retreat and take off from work or whatever and engage in some kind of spiritual pursuits. But for her, there was no such thing. And the option was to, that she knew was to do this renunciant life, this contemplative life. So it must have been pretty important for her. After she was ordained, she went to the Buddha and asked him this question. It would be good if you would teach me the Dharma in brief. And this is something that people in these ancient teachings, periodically, in the records of it, people periodically are coming to the Buddha and asking him that question. Can you teach me the Dharma in brief? And it's fascinating to go through and see his answers, to see the overall character or the thrust of what he thinks is important when he's going to say it in brief. And this is one example of this. But she goes on, this is again the context. It would be good if the Blessed One, the Buddha, would teach me the Dharma in brief, so that, having heard the Dharma from the Buddha, from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, secluded, ardent, and resolute. So this is a great four qualities. So alone, secluded, ardent, and resolute. And so remember, you couldn't just sign up for a retreat to go off and practice. Mostly what people, if they're going to engage in retreat life and in a deep, engagement in meditation practice, they would have to go off and practice alone. And you didn't have to register for retreats and end up in the waiting list. You would just go off someplace and meditate. And this idea of dwelling alone, which without context seems like that's kind of a lonely thing to do. Secluded sounds like it's maybe kind of unfriendly. Ardent and resolute. But that's a little bit what we do when we go off on retreats. We're not exactly alone. We have maybe at our retreat center maybe 40 people who are with you on retreat, but we're in silence. And we're kind of stepping away from our ordinary social world, work world that we have, in order to be apart from it and not be stimulated by it, not be caught up in the concerns we have of that, so that we can do a deeper look at ourselves, really delve in deep into some other aspect of ourselves and our reality that we wouldn't be able to if we're concerned about details of work or family life or politics or something. And and so she's saying, I'm here, I'm ready to go and really practice and devote myself to a practice, to go off on a retreat alone. And I'm ardent, I have a lot of energy and dedication for this, and I'm resolute. So this is I kind of take her as a very strong person. And she's here, I'm resolute. So she's about to go off on retreat, she's determined, she's clear, she wants to practice, and she's going to really, that's the context in which she's asking for the Dharma. She wants teachings to take with her and to help support her in that context. Okay? So, you ready for the Dharma in brief? And maybe you should imagine yourself inspired to go on retreat. I was thinking about people who come and talk to me, some of them recently, about things like, I tried everything. I tried therapy, I tried recreational activities of all kinds, I tried all kinds of things, and what I didn't try was to turn towards my suffering. And that's what I learned through Buddhism, and it made all the difference. I learned to be mindful of it and turn towards it and sit in the fire. And that's what transformed me. I know people who have gone through some years of a career, and they were interested enough in it, but it didn't really touch some deep existential issues they had or a deep sense of meaning and purpose of their life. And they kind of felt flat for them after a while. And for whatever reason, when they heard about the Dharma, the practice, the teachings, that really spoke to them and spoke to some depth of who they are. Say, this is purposeful life. This is meaningful, to transform myself in the deep way of liberation, of freedom, of resolving these deep suffering, of touching into some of the deepest qualities and aspects of our lives and so on. This is important for me. So people will make that transition. And so she's resolute and ardent. She's made this turn. She asked the Buddha the Dharma in brief. So the Buddha responds this way. Those things that you may know. The word things is Dharma, is the Pali original language. The word Dharma has many meanings. And sometimes it's translated as teachings. Sometimes it's translated as practices we do. And sometimes what it means is qualities of mind. And sometimes it just means just things, and is things, you know, objects kind of. So it means a lot of different meanings. So it kind of shifts and changes. So what exactly she's asking for when she says for the Dharma in brief. For me, when I read that, I say, the teachings in brief. But when the Buddha responds, the dharmas that you know, in the plural, it's either practices you can do or qualities of mind you want to cultivate and develop. So again, if my interpretation is accurate, she's asking about teaching, and he's not going to present doctrine. He's going to present something different, practices and qualities of mind. This is what's important. And so again, the context is to be on retreat. These things that you may know, this leads to lust, not to the fading of lust. This leads to bondage, not to freedom from bondage. This leads to accumulation, not to shedding. This leads to many desires, not to few desires. This leads to discontentment, not to contentment. This leads to crowds, not to solitude. This leads to laziness, not to arousing effort. This leads to being difficult to support, not to being easy to support. You should definitely regard this as not being the Dharma. This is not, then he adds the discipline, the Vinaya. This is not the teacher's message, the teacher's sasana. Some of you know the word sasana. Sometimes it's translated dispensation. So first he tells her, these are not what you should regard or hold as what the Dharma, the discipline, or the message is all about. And then he goes on. But, Gotami, those things that you know, this leads to the fading of lust, not to lust. This leads to freedom from bondage, not to bondage. This leads to shedding, not to accumulation. This leads to fewness of desires, not to many desires. This leads to contentment, not to discontentment. This leads to solitude, not to crowds. This leads to arousing effort, not to laziness. This leads to being easy to support, not to being difficult to support. You should definitely regard, this is the Dharma, this is the discipline, this is the teacher's message. So this emphatic idea, this is the Dharma, this is the discipline, this is the message, that's kind of remarkable. Now, I think some people who, you know, have this background that a religion has certain tenets of belief that you're supposed to believe, would find themselves maybe even a little lost in this sphere. But I'm supposed to believe something, hold on to something. There must be some teaching about reality, about human beings, about the purpose of life, or something that's some kind of ultimate teaching. Especially, it has to be something about the truth. And remarkably, the Buddha very explicitly said that it's a kind of an attachment, unnecessary attachment, that he discourages people to have, to hold on to or champion some ultimate truth. So this is the ultimate truth, this is the ultimate experience, this is the ultimate reality. And that's also a little confusing for people who are used to, you know, common religious ideas, because that's what religions are championing. Like, this is ultimate truth, this is really what it's all about. And that can be very reassuring to feel like you know, some truth about the cosmos, the reality, this is the ultimate truth. It's reassuring for this chaotic, maybe difficult to understand life that we live, not to have that kind of certainty. The Buddha didn't seem to provide that certainty in terms of you know, classic ideas of doctrine and ultimate truth. The certainty he provided was with a transformation, a personal transformation, that you see yourself and see the world differently through that transformation, perhaps. And the word in this translation here, these things lead to the fading of lust. The word lead is maybe misleading. The Pali word has the word to turn, and so to transform, to turn around. This turns one or transforms one to the fading of lust. This transforms one to the freedom from bondage. This transforms one to shedding, not to accumulation. Transforms one towards contentment. So for some people, I think maybe these kinds of qualities are kind of nice, but they're kind of garden variety, and they're kind of, you know, just kind of ordinary, common values that make us, you know, good citizens or something. And but if you reflect that this Gotami was going off on retreat, and the kind of self-insight we get when we really sit alone for a long period of time, really sit with ourselves and settle ourselves, that these things, these qualities that Buddha is encouraging here, the focus becomes increasingly subtle or deeper within. What we start seeing is the opposite of these good qualities, the lust, bondage, accumulation, having many desires, being discontented, being lazy, all those things don't feel good. They're unsatisfying. They keep us in an agitated, contracted state. Keep us kind of spinning and often in our thoughts and ideas. And it can, you can feel somatically that this doesn't feel good. That this feels... And so then there's a desire to move towards that which feels better or feels more right or feels more, in some case, deeply satisfying. And that's these other qualities. So it's a movement of transformation from aspects and qualities of mind which are contracted or agitating or painful to have into something which is the opposite, not painful, not contracted, not agitated, that are peaceful. And that movement from the agitated, contracted, attached state to a peaceful, expansive, and non-attached state is that's the movement, that's a transformation that the Buddha was emphasizing. And if you do that thoroughly and completely, then whatever the strong attachment to having the truth, the fear that if I don't have the truth, I'll somehow miss something, will be shed, will be transformed. Because you'll feel that you'll come to a place where there's no more fear. There's no more attachment. And so some of the very things that sometimes drive people to search for the truth and have the truth and to profess the truth and get other people to believe the truth. And look at this, I have, this is what this person says, and whatever. That is... That gets shed, that gets settled away in the context of this deep retreat that this Gotami is going off to do. And then to come to an abiding sense of peace and well-being. That's the direction it's going. So it's a little bit worthwhile, I think, just going through these things that how you would know this is the Dharma. So if you really wanted to get read about the Dharma, you'd read your own heart and find these qualities in yourself. So that's what you recognize it. And if you read a Dharma book, hopefully it's a mirror for you to kind of look into yourself and maybe begin touching into to seeing how this works for yourself. So the fading of lust, viraga, the fading of lust. I love that idea that the word is usually translated as fading. So it's not like all or nothing. It's not like, you know, I got to, you know, go to 0 to 60 in 1 second, you know, and just be free of lust. But rather, I think it's a very mature recognition that the ways in which we get caught in this very strong form of attachment, which what braga is, around desire, kind of a certain kind of attached, powerful passion, that this is a, you know, deep part of human life, human being, human psychology to have this. And so we're working with kind of almost primal energies within ourselves. And so it takes a while, takes patience to learn how not to be caught in it, or how to settle it down, or you know, it's a process. So there's a patience, there's a lot of honesty, there's a lot of learning how to hold things with compassion and care so that we can work through these forms of lust. Now some of you might feel there's nothing wrong with lust. You like your lust. And you have a good time with it. That could well be, but you haven't gone on retreat yet. Context is important, right? In certain areas of life, certain kinds of desires are important and great. But in other contexts, it's a whole different, you know, movement. It's a whole different way of being and sensitivity and to ourselves. That we see that a lot of times. Some of you might love to play your trumpet, right? And it's a wonderful thing, and you're lots of love for trumpet playing. And so you go to the movies or to a funeral, and you say, well, I should be able to play my trumpet. But, you know, in different contexts, right? It would be the wrong place. And if you had a strong desire to play the trumpet in the wrong context, you know, I think then it's really an issue of looking at what's the driving you? Why are you caught in that? And that's what happens on retreats. It's a very different context. And it's not to say that certain things are wrong, but in certain contexts of getting deeper and deeper settled, we have a different relationship with this. And we feel that it's off, or it's unsatisfying, or it's agitating. So the fading of lust. As lust fades, then the mind becomes quieter and stiller, and it's able to see more clearly, see what's going on. We can feel and know ourselves better. And this idea of getting to know ourselves better from the inside out, to have a heightened sensitivity to ourselves, that's, I think, where we continue to discover where the Dharma is and the path for ourselves. It's a beautiful thing to find that's where the path is. And then freedom from bondage. This is also a very powerful word. You know, the English word is bondage. It's kind of, it's a little footnote, that the word is, in Pali, is samyoga. It has the word yoga in it. So that's nice. I'm going to go down to yoga. Yoga and yoke are a closely connected word, you know, the yoke of a horse or something, or a cow. It's that which, it also can mean that which binds. And so it's also used for bondage, to be caught in our attachments. And so as lust and agitated mind quiets, we start seeing the power of our attachments. And compulsive desires are a kind of bondage. And so to be able to free ourselves from that as we settle and go deeper down. And then it leads to shedding, not accumulation. I've been on solitary retreats in little cabins, little huts, kutis they're called, in the woods. And one of the exquisite things about it is there's nothing there except for my, you know, blanket and, you know, a few little things. There's an empty desk sometimes a little wooden bed, and really nothing there. And just exquisite to be in this, you know, I haven't brought with me everything, you know, that I could possibly own, you know, and and, you know, fill the room with clutter and stuff. And the simplicity of that, of shedding and shedding all the kind of accumulations that a person can have. It can be, for some people, that simplification process, at least on retreat, is a beautiful thing. And and then leads to fewness of desires. Fewness of desires. When I was younger, I painfully became aware of how agitating and tiring it was to have many desires. I was specialty I had. And now I can feel how delightful it is not to be driven by all these desires and have them racing and spinning and wanting and this and that. And to have fewness of desires is a beautiful thing. You know, it's a simplicity, and it allows for a different way of living. It allows for a different connection to myself, to the world around me, that I didn't have when I saw the world through the filter of all these desires I had. And then as we have fewness of desires, there can come more contentment, a certain kind of healthy contentment with what is. And then as a footnote, there is in the Dharma practice a healthy form of discontentment. So to be discontented with discontentment is good, because then you can move towards contentment, for example. And then solitude, not to crowds. And I would say that I know that the first movement for me towards the life and practice of Buddhism, my deeper appreciation of the potential there, was after when I was about 21 or so, I spent a week alone for the first time in my life, and on a small farm. And there was something about what all these things settled in my mind. The social concerns that I didn't know, I was spinning with social concerns and ideas and I said and who said and talking and all that. And not to have anyone to talk to for a week, something in my mind settled and quieted. And my eyesight and my hearing became quite acute. And I was fascinated. I mean, I was just, everything was sparkling. It was kind of like being on retreat, but I didn't know what retreats were. So I wasn't meditating. I was just kind of not talking or seeing any people. And so this idea of the blessings of a certain kind of solitude and discovering what that blessing is and learning the ability to abide in deep solitude is not an easy thing to come to. There's a lot of difficult, challenging needs that people have to kind of sort through around our social life. That takes a while, but to come to that is a beautiful thing, to have that ability. And then arousing effort, not to being lazy. So I kind of like it that it comes after all these others, because if you've let go of lust and a lot of being caught in attachment and a lot of having lots of desires and discontentment, and now we're talking about arousing desire, effort, then probably the effort's going to be a little more healthy, because sometimes making effort, people just make it worse for themselves because there's so much expectation and desire and wanting that goes into it. But it's, the Buddha emphasized repeatedly that the Dharma he was teaching is not for the lazy. So, you know, to really engage in it and then to find out what that appropriate effort is that's freeing is part of the art. And then the final one, easy to support. And, Gotami, he was teaching, was a nun, and the monastics, all their livelihood is supported by lay people, by their generosity. So they're supposed to be really simple and easy to support, so not to be a burden for others. But my interpretation of this for myself is that to live in a way that it's easy to take care of our basic needs, so that we're not burdened with a lot of time and effort and money and all kinds of that we need in order to have a lifestyle, perhaps, that interferes with our ability to do this deep transformative work. So to have a simple lifestyle so that we can, you know, those of us who want to do this work can really go into it. So So we're talking about a transformation that does, as we go through all this, transform our attachments to freedom, step by step, deeper and deeper. And on retreat, these guidelines maybe can take a person all the way to freedom. So what I'd like to suggest as we come to an end here is that I would like to name each of these eight qualities. And while I do so, maybe if you'd like, maybe close your eyes and listen to them as if you are maybe on a retreat or maybe in a very nice space. You're quite set, you may be as settled or as peaceful or as that you've ever been in your life. Situation where there's not a lot you have to do and you're not worried about things particularly. And maybe there's been a time like that that you can remember or you can feel. And in this context of maybe feeling this way, listen to each of these qualities as if it's kind of an attitude, it's kind of a state that maybe you can feel physically, mentally, maybe in your heart somehow, kind of like open to that. Say, in a certain kind of way, say yes to each of these and see what responds inside. The fading of lust. Freedom from bondage. Shedding. Fewness of desires. Contentment. Solitude. Arousing effort. Being easy to support. This is the Dharma. This is the discipline. This is the teacher's message.